Fisher versus the University of Texas. Mr. Ryan, is it? I should know by now.
I give an honorary citizen.
May it please the court. This case comes before this court under the Supreme Court's mandate to apply strict scrutiny to determine whether the race preferences in the UT admission system are constitutional. In order to make that determination, the court must look at two questions as set forth by the Supreme Court. One, was the decision to use race a necessary decision? Was the use of race, and is the use of race in 2008, was it necessary to achieve a bona fide legitimate educational goal? And second, to determine whether the way that race is used is narrowly tailored to advance those goals.
Mr. Ryan, let me ask you a question. If the University of Texas confronting this situation of underrepresented minorities had simply not gone to the 10% plan, but then when it became available, they went to the Grutter plan and admitted 100% of its students in that manner, would we be here today?
Well, it would depend on the targets they set under the Grutter plan, because the Grutter plan says that if you're going to use race as one of the factors, if we mean by the Grutter plan...
All facts the same. The only change is the election, which the university made and was not obligated by law to do, is that it used that particular method, instead went straight to the holistic use of race under Bakke.
Understood. I was just trying to clarify. I think the answer to that would be we might well be here today if they were unable to establish a critical mass goal and demonstrate how the tools they were using were fit to that goal. So it's hypothetical and it's hard to answer, but I don't think the critical element is necessarily the 10% plan. What the 10% plan does, it sets a base on minority admissions. You know where you are under the 10% plan because you've got quite a predictable and increasing...
I understand that, Mike. Let me go at it a slightly different way. Let's talk to you about what the narrative here, and as you stated, the narrative as to whether we have narrow tailoring begins after the 10% plan. Because most of the briefing focuses on that. Let me put it to you that there's a very powerful argument. The narrative doesn't begin there. The narrative begins earlier. Texas confronts the situation first that legally they cannot use any race, and for 6 years they tried that. When they went to the 10% plan, it was accompanied by a form of a holistic examination itself. For the reason that without that 20% and without that holistic examination, you would suffer greatly, and the university would suffer a great deal, and you may not really be able to fulfill their diversity at all for other reasons. What I'm saying to you, it's step one in narrowing, when we look at all the things that the university did or didn't do, is that they took, the first thing they did was take a non-facially racial program, which was not obligated to take, and admitted 80% of their students through that. Now, do they get credit for that, or does the story begin afterward to say, well, that's interesting, but we don't want to talk about that?
Well, I think that we certainly take into account that they were obligated by law to use the top 10 system, and that top 10 system had a...
They weren't obligated by constitutional law, and the Supreme Court said rejected the government's argument that resort to the 10% plan was required for narrow tailoring for the reason that it had a number of deficits. But what I'm suggesting to you is that the accompanying holistic examination, first without race and then with additional race, was, on the facts of this case, arguably an essential component of the 10% plan. Without the 10% plan, with 10% plan only, you have this problem. You have in Texas segregated schools, Dallas Independent School District, 90%+ minority majority, et cetera. So most of your numbers are coming from, that's why it worked, sweeping those off the top. But the other circumstance, and this is the background of it. The other circumstance here is that those minority schools are underperforming schools. Just take that as an assumption for the moment.
Well,
I guess true or not, they're underperforming. So you have those graduates that you're sweeping in. What's not admitted with the minorities are in that plan are the, what do you do with the minorities in the majority white districts where they're like 90% white and 5% and 6%? And we're not talking about, there's a few things, we're talking about the major metropolitan areas of this state.
Well, let me say this. I don't think it makes a difference analytically whether the top 10 plan was put in place by the university or put in place by the legislature. It was there. That plan had a discernible impact on the total number of minorities that would be admitted to the University of Texas. So the question we're asking is broader. Did they set a goal for minority admissions that was critical mass? And if so, had they reached it, or were they reaching it at the time, or did they need to do more? And if they needed to do more, did they do it in a narrowly tailored way?
Are you suggesting that we look only at the year 2008?
Well, I think you have to look at the history. You have to look at what was going
exactly,
on.
But the numbers,
well,
or whatever the program that was placed 2008.
Well, I think you're looking at a program that's continuing, but in fact, the focus is the year in which Ms. Fisher was not admitted, in which she was processed under this system. So yes, the focus is 2008, but what was happening previously, what was predictable in 2008 in terms of racial admissions is critical to the case. So you can't just isolate a snapshot. The record does not go on beyond that, so we don't know if they changed the system in 2009, whether they have different goals and different targets. But Judge Higginbotham, the answer to your question is, if you're going to use race as a tool, a visible tool, which under your hypothesis they're going to do, they're going to put it in the PAI, then you have certain obligations that the Supreme Court imposed, and those have to be met.
Factually, you misstated it. They didn't for 6 years. When the 10% plan was adopted, it was accompanied by the AI, PAI. It was an effort it was, as I read it, a necessary component of the 10%. So what I'm saying to you is that I want your comment about why that doesn't count. They did not adopt a facially racial program. They went to the 10% plan, but the package of that, the necessary component of that, was the 20%.
Well, let me answer it this way. Before 2004, when they weren't using race, we're not here to criticize their determination that on top of the 10% plan, you should use a system that looked for broader considerations. That's an academic decision. There's no criticism in our presentation of the PAI system as it was used up until 2004. The case is about something quite different. It's the injection of race, and race changes the equation. That's the point of it. So if they want to go back and just say, look, you know, we'd like to, they now have 25%. We'd like those 25% to reflect a broader view of the kind of students that we think will be beneficial, and they're going to use a non-racial PAI system. We're not here to criticize that. We're not here to run the educational institution. We're here to deal with the election to use race as a consideration that makes the difference between whether you're admitted or not admitted.
Well, you know, you talk about the 10% system as being race neutral, but of course it wasn't race neutral, and it wasn't even intended to be race neutral. It was intended in part to have a racial impact. Otherwise, the system would have been much more white at the University of Texas than it is under the 10% rule. But that consideration of race that played a role in the 10% law had victims. And the victims were in the next 10%. And I guess the question is, why can we not focus on the victims of a rule which keeps being described as racially neutral, but in fact was not, and was not even intended to be?
Well, any rule that you use, as you just pointed out, the AI rule, you could say, had a discernible racial component. That is, it was allowing more whites and Asians to be admitted than were admitted in the 10%. So any rule that you use, any admission system, can be reduced to a determination of what does it mean for race. But when you visibly use race, when you inject it into it, that's what the Supreme Court has focused on. The Supreme Court has not said, well, we're going to look at facially neutral systems and determine whether the racial outcome is somehow cognizable. Because you're talking about outcomes, not system.
I'm talking also about intent. I mean, insofar as one can describe the intent of the Texas legislature, it certainly had partly a racial intent.
Well, I don't have a record on their intent, and it's very hard to read the legislature.
Well, why don't we use the Supreme Court standard in Feeney, the Veterans Preference Plan, as Justice Stewart posited it, the question in whether the presence of intent requisite to violate the Equal Protection Clause is answered by the inquiry of did this adverse impact upon women by veterans' preference, was that enacted because of that impact or in spite of that impact? Now, you put that test to the 10% plan, what do you have? It was certainly enacted because of its impact. That's the whole purpose of it. I won't call it a pretense, but we have currently the mindset that that really is a race-neutral thing. If it's race-neutral, then they would have done it.
Well, I think that what we're talking about is it has an impact, as everybody agrees, on the admission of so-called underrepresented minorities, and that has to be taken into account. It's a fact. It's a pre-existing circumstance that UT has to live with, and therefore it affects how necessary is it to use race in the PAAIS system.
Well, let me take it in a different tack. Let's go to Bakke. The Supreme Court's revalidated that. You agree with that, I take it. That we look at the multifactored holistic examination into a diverse student body. Take the 10% plan without any other adjustments, with the underperforming schools that are producing a substantial contribution. What will be manifested by that, and the record will show this, is that those students are going to tend to be clustered. Now, you've been critical of that, so that doesn't matter. They're in the university. But what happens is that what that ignores is that cluster of people who are underperforming, and on the other side, what's admitting are the non-minorities from these high-performing schools. And so the first time that these students come from these secondary schools in Texas really go to an integrated school system, the whites and the blacks are looking at each other, and the picture of the black are underperformance. That underperformers, that to me creates the stigma and the badges that the Justice Thomas rightly complains about. And that's right in the teeth and intention with Bakke, which didn't contemplate that.
Let me just answer that directly.
We need to let you do some arguing, don't we?
It would be nice. And I'm trying to answer Judge Higginbotham because previously, in your previous opinion, Judge Higginbotham, you expressed dissatisfaction with the top 10 system. Judge King pointed out it was not before the court. Had not been put into issue. So, and I understand that view.
The validity of the plan is not an issue. But you can't erase the history of it. It is highly relevant. And the question here before us is where Texas has, looking at the hard data, what have they done and did they do before they brought race in? And I'm just suggesting to you that what you do is that you ignore the 10% plan on any credit balance of that.
I've got
three pages of things they've done here that are omitted from your brief and are contrary to the statements in your brief.
Of course, I don't know what they are, but
I don't want to take your time.
We are the ones who've taken. We recognize the top 10. When this case started, UT said, just look at the AAPAI system in isolation, forget the top 10. And we've said, no, the top 10 does predictably increase minority enrollments. If that's a goal, it operates in that manner, and therefore the question is, what else do you have to do, and whether you've tailored what you have to do to that objective. You know, in our view, by 2004, the university had predictably reached what anybody would deem to be a critical mass of minority students.
What is that number?
When we say that, it's not our burden to name the critical mass. The university has got to.
But you make the statement that they reached it. By what metric?
Because when we look at the minority admissions and the rising curve of minority admissions, that were well over 20%, and we haven't seen any justification. They have the burden. The Supreme Court said they have the burden. So where's the justification for going further than that? It was the issue Judge King raised in her dissent from rehearing. There's no justification. This system, this election to use race visibly and to inject it into the PAAI system had to be justified by first analyzing what are our objectives, how do they translate into some kind of target? Because if you can't quantify it, if you say it's all qualitative, we know it when we see it, that's the university's position, don't bother us, you're going back to deference. And when deference was in the decision before, the Supreme Court said, no, there is no deference. There's no deference, it's strict scrutiny, it's the duty of the court, because you cannot have any use of race unless there is meaningful, strict scrutiny. They go together. It's love and marriage. As soon as one fails, they both fail. And then you have to take race out of it. So it is true. Any admission system, we can all see it, is going to have some kind of impact. The impact may be racial, maybe geographic. One of the things that the top 10 system does, it expands the number of Texas high schools that are sending students to UT. Another thing, as the record shows, those students perform. Now, you can say, well, they come from, you know, high schools that are not as rigorous, but the fact is they perform. That's what
do you mean by perform? You mean they got in?
No. What I mean by perform is
What about math, sciences, school of business, and so forth? They're not in those schools. They're clustered.
And let me say, that's not the fault of the admission system. That's the fault of the University of Texas, because the secondary admission system they put in place, that's what sorts them out. So at the admissions level, the top 10 says you're in. But then they set up a wholly different set of criteria for admission to those schools. So if they want to cure that, they should attack that problem directly.
Well, your argument is that they should drop the barriers for the complete entry from the 10% plan.
I think
School of Business took 4% approximately, and then the first to generate the 75%, but the main 25% came out of the alternate plan.
They capped the top 10, and then they made them compete. So they don't really, and the cap is more nuanced than that. But the point is that if their problem is the distribution of the minorities within the university, then they have to tailor a means to solve the problem. And you don't tailor a means to solve that problem by throwing race into the AAPIA. You can't connect them. So, yes, that if that's an issue, if that's one of their objectives, and it was the objective of their so-called classroom diversity study, then narrow tailoring demands that you do something about it, not that you just say, well, that's a good excuse, so let's just throw race into the AAPII. They haven't done a study. They haven't shown that the candidates admit it. I mean, they're talking that way, but where's the study? Where's the basis for concluding that if we allow candidates in on the AAPIA system, they will actually go into business and engineering? There's no evidence for that. There's not a shred of it. They have the burden. So it may be a hypothesis, you know, and you can have all the hypotheses you want, but they never studied it, and they don't know the answer to that. But they did say in 1993, the president said, you know what? The students we allow in the top 10, they're diligent, and they outperform the non-top 10 students. It's in the record. We cited it to the record. So that's where they stand, and that's probably the truth, because the top 10 measures diligence. It measures effort. And so we didn't invent it. It was there. And what we're saying is it is accountable. It's part of the system.
UT says that in the top 10%, that the PAI, that they have the higher SAT scores, and you say that the top 10% admittees fare better overall in terms of retention and graduation.
Right.
We looked at the record, and both those statements are correct.
Yes.
And then the question becomes, which is the better indicator of the purpose that the educational mission is there to enhance?
Well, certainly as they framed it, and as we believe, it is to successfully graduate students who have been trained at UT. The fact that a student may have potential as measured by the SAT, that's a factor in determining how well they might do, because it goes into what they call the projected grade point average. How well will they do at the university? But when push comes to shove, what you care about is getting people educated and graduated, and that's what the top 10, they said, was doing.
And specifically, they claim that the SAT scores of the top 10% of the underrepresented minorities were lower than their counterparts admitted under the full file review, the PAI review.
Yeah, that's what the numbers show, but I think, you know, and that may be a characteristic, and again, they haven't studied and explained why. It's an observation, but it doesn't have to do with success at the university. It doesn't have to do with grades. It doesn't have to do with graduation. That's the objective. It's not just to pick students with the high SATs. If they wanted to do that, they could say, we're going to go a non-racial system.
See, that's one of the other problems, I think. You know, the mission statement states that diversity is for the betterment of the university. It does not define the mission vis-a-vis the minorities that are admitted, the benefit of the minorities that admitted, but the benefit of the university. And it seems to be there seems to be some tension, which I'll ask the university at the proper time.
Well, I think, you know, under Grutter, I mean, the Supreme Court recognized an educational interest in enriching dialogue and exchange in the classroom, they said, coming out of having a critical mass of minority students. So,
but that seems to imply a goal outside the interests of the minority students themselves to graduate.
That, you know, I think that's correct, that it was directed not at the minority students, but supposedly at, in fact, the majority.
And, of course, that comes out of Bakke as the only seam that withstands strict scrutiny.
Well, I think the reason for that was that there's a cloud in this case, which is the university's thrown up, the distinction between holism, that is, the determination by the university that the candidates they seek cannot just be picked under academic criteria, PGPA, let's pick the ones. The university has latitude to say, that's not necessarily the best mix and the best class. We look for other characteristics. And so long as they're non-racial, they've got great latitude in doing that. They are the academy. But if you pick race, if you cross that line, you have to be prepared to withstand strict scrutiny. And to withstand strict scrutiny, you've got to be able to show why that was necessary, why the racial component was necessary, and how you tailored so that you precisely met
the need. Is it your understanding that the way this is scored is they look at the academic index first, then the personal achievement index second, and only after that's looked at does race play a factor?
No, I think that the race is integrated into the so-called PAI. So the academic index is independently calculated.
Where's the record? Where would I find that in the record? I have an affidavit here that says exactly the opposite. I don't. Can you sometime give me a record cite of that?
I would be happy. The record is clear, and the Supreme Court is clear. The system and the way the matrix is set up across the top is the AI, and the AI is calculated on very specified algorithms that they have put into the record.
So the PAI, however, the PAI is race is an integral factor.
It is, and the reason for that.
And what I'm saying is this. Is it the last factor that is used, or is it an integrated factor within the?
According to their testimony, it affects in an integrated way 4/7 of the PAI grade. 3/7 of the PAI grade, according to the university, is on two essays that are scored by their content, their English composition, the clarity of the ideas, non-racial basis, albeit that the race of the candidate is right on the application. But that's their testimony. The other 4/7 are personal achievement factors, and in that context, the reviewer can apply race. So when they talk about a factor of a factor of a factor, that's how it's listed. But as they use it operatively, it is contextual, as they might say, to the 4/7. And those 4/7 become part of the PAI grade. The PAI grade is on the left-hand side of that axis, and that's in the record. And then it is translated into numbers and boxes, and at the point of admission, they're just drawing lines around the numbers and boxes. So it is a system which is individual only up to a point, because at the point of admission decision for each of the components, which is the way they do it, you're only dealing with numbers. So if you pick out this idealized hypothetical candidate from a Highland Park High School in the Dallas suburbs, you really have no assurance that one's going to be picked. Because that one might choose to compete in a very hard major. And whatever the PAI is, may fail on the AI. And so unlike Bakke, where Justice Powell's talking about a very individualized comparison, we have A and B and C, and they have different attributes. And we're trying to adjust the overall composition of the class by the Harvard plan. That doesn't happen here. It can't because of the way it's done.
All right, your time is coming to an end, and I'm going to stick with the time rules. So
yes, I'm done.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. You saved 5 minutes.
I'll clear the podium for Mr. Garr.
Mr. Garr.
Thank you, Judge King, and may it please the court. Maybe I could begin with Judge Higginbotham's first question to my friend, which is whether this plan would be constitutional if you took the 10% plan out of the equation. And I think the answer to that is, I think all three of the judges recognized in the last appeal, unquestionably, is yes. The only difference between this plan and the Grutter plan is that the plan at issue in this case is more individualized, and the consideration of race is more modest, and so therefore it is more constitutional on Grutter. Now,
Mr. Garr, I better question you on that one. It seems to me that we were under, and this is why it came back, under the belief that deference and good faith was almost accepted by the university, and we have to start from the premise that you have the burden, and deference other than the mission statement is not there. We have to look at this strictly to find that it's narrowly tailored and necessary to the mission statement.
No question, Your Honor. No question at all. And our central submission is that when this court engages in that searching review, it will conclude that the plan is narrowly tailored to its objectives. Now, I think if you look at the first question of is the plan sufficiently individualized and is the consideration of race sufficiently modest under Grutter and Bakke to pass strict scrutiny, I don't think my friend seriously questions this at that point. Now, that was the focus of the case in Grutter. And that sort of dropped out of this case. The areas that they focus on are, one, whether or not the university is as adequately considered race-neutral alternatives, and the focus of that is on the percentage plan. And then, two, is the impact of race in this plan paradoxically too small to be constitutional?
Is it important to pass strict scrutiny that in this plan the last step is not the racial step, but is integrated in the PAI determination? In other words, one can have, if you go through the AI determination, and that's objective, and then you take the PAI determination without race, and that's subjective to a certain extent and certain figures. And then as the last step, race is plugged into the equation. That's not the case. Does that defeat the constitutionality of this?
Not at all, Your Honor. And I think just to explain the way the plan operates is you have the academic index, which is calculated based on test scores and grades, and then you have the personal achievement index, which takes into account essays and then takes into account the personal achievement score. One factor of a factor is race. And then those two criteria, the academic index and the personal achievement index, are put on a grid, and the admit decision is based at that point on a race-blind basis. Now, I think in terms of the consideration of race, I think all that means is that clearly the consideration of race is individualized. The admissions officers are looking at the whole file in holistic review and coming up with that personal achievement score. So that is clearly an individualized process, just like it was in Grutter and Bakke. And with respect to the ultimate admissions decision, to admit or deny, it means that race is even more insulated at that step. And so I would think that our opponents would find that more constitutionally beneficial. I don't think that it's a constitutional flaw that at the ultimate admissions decision, race isn't playing as prominent a role. And so I think that any way you look at this, just in terms of whether the plan is individualized and the consideration of race is modest, the University of Texas has met its burden that this plan is unconstitutional in Grutter, and that's why they've put the focus on the presence of the percentage plan and this question, paradoxical in our view, that the consideration of race is just too modest to be constitutional.
Well, what I feel that view of, quote, too modest is that it's a minimalist view use of race in the total picture, but it is only the necessary amount of race that is essential to mitigate the difficulties that the 10% plan itself adopts.
No, that's right. The university has looked at what was happening for 7 years with the percentage plan and with the holistic review without the consideration of race. And what happened? African Americans suffered considerably. The percentage of African Americans enrollment nearly dropped in half. Hispanics remain largely stagnant or worse, but within that pool of admissions candidates, the second deciles, the statistics shows that African American and Hispanic candidates were losing ground. And the university, looking at its classrooms, getting feedback from the students, looking at the indicia of racial isolation and racial climate, concluded that it had not attained a critical mass and that further measures were warranted. Those are all firmly supported in the record, Your Honor.
Mr. Gard, you bring up an issue that I want to make sure we touch on, and that is admissions under this policy is admissions to the university, not necessarily to the college.
Well, it's just to make clear that we're on the same page here. Students apply to particular colleges, like Ms. Fisher applied to liberal arts and business administration, and they're admitted to those schools,
but
or denied. Sure.
And is there any data of those in the PAI plan that were admitted to the university and did not get their first or second choices?
Well, that
is there data?
I don't know specific data in this record, but that's not unusual.
Well, that's one of the problems with this. It seems to me you are arguing that there's not enough Hispanics and blacks in classrooms when the second tier admission system, for lack of a better word, discriminates against them in entering those higher qualified engineering, nursing, business, because of their status as not being admitted in the first chunk of the admittees.
I think that argument, Your Honor, is one that the university should consider race even more than it does, which would be a surprising argument to come from our opponents. The university is focusing first and foremost on increasing student body diversity at the University of Texas.
But wait a minute. Your argument before was classroom diversity.
Classroom diversity was one way in which...
And you can't, let me suggest to you that you can't have classroom diversity without a plan to admit those minorities into engineering and nursing and all these other colleges that I know are very competitive, and that's why it's not there. But it seems to me that you can't even use that data to show lack of diversity, because the university itself has set a separate standard to admission into those colleges.
Your Honor, I think if you look at the classroom diversity, the results of that study were so shocking that the university, isn't at the point where it can say, geez, we need more diversity in this particular major or that particular. 90% of the classes, there was zero or one African American. 43% of the classes, the smaller classes studied, there was 40, zero or one Hispanic. And so, I take your point that it would be, the university may well view it as being better to have that spread out. But that's not the basis of their
approach. Mr. Garr, I don't think you're answering my question. You're answering it at a level of generality that doesn't answer the specific question. But let's go on. Define critical mass. How does UT define critical mass?
Sure. It comes straight out of Grutter, Your Honor. It's a meaningful representation of minorities such that the educational benefits of diversity can be achieved. And what that means is a university in which minorities don't feel like spokespersons for their race, a university in which minorities don't feel racially isolated, a racial climate in which students can benefit from the lively exchange of different viewpoints and perspectives, including from different racial perspectives.
Well, the plan in the case says that agrees with that formulation, but says that the only way you meet that and the index that you can go by is simply the numbers.
Well, the Supreme Court didn't say that, Your Honor.
No, your counsel opposite did.
No, that's right. And the Supreme Court rejected that in Bakke and Grutter, and it did so again in the Fisher case, which is to say that they made clear that diversity isn't measured by specific percentages. It's diversity in the broad sense, looking at all characteristics.
But isn't that one of the problems with Grutter? You can't use specific numbers, and yet we have to look at this through strict scrutiny with a view of making sure that this quote critical mass, that's either the definitions I've seen are either tautological, circular, or subjective. And in fact, you say in page 48 that we will determine, you know, when this is reached, when it occurs. I guess you must know. You'll know it when you see it.
And we would look to several data points that we've laid out in our briefs. But to answer your question, Your Honor, we don't view that as a problem. But, of course, to the extent that the court does, that's a decision that's been made by the Supreme Court and is reaffirmed in this very case. And the court in the prior opinion suggested that the critical mass is a more abstract qualitative concept. And I think that that's largely right. But that doesn't mean that universities can't determine when a critical mass has been reached. And that doesn't mean that courts can't look at that consideration. Now, in this case, I think we've spelled this out in our briefs, but the question of whether or not the university achieved a critical mass in 2004 or 2008 goes to the compelling interest side of the equation. Judge Garza, you
really?
Said, yeah, you said in your prior concurring opinion, this is from page 259, the plaintiffs here argue that the University of Texas' interest in obtaining a racially diverse student body is not compelling because the university has already achieved a critical mass by way of Texas's top 10%.
And that presumes that we gave full deference and good faith to the university, which the Supreme Court said we do not. Justice Robert asked, if UT is not willing to specify critical mass, how can we tell that the plan is narrowly tailored to that goal?
And we have specified it, Your Honor. It's the same definition of critical mass that the Supreme Court upheld in Grutter. Now, Chief Justice Roberts may not have agreed with that definition, but it's the one that comes straight out of the majority decision in that case. Well, and this court can measure it, Your Honor.
Well, stay with that definition and look at the want of dispersal across the classrooms and so forth. Those on its face are on the data are directly traceable to the operative effect of sweeping students from underperforming schools and putting them in competition with students from much higher performing schools, relatively speaking. Why isn't the absence of dispersal across classrooms itself a very powerful evidence that that the university looks at it, that they are not getting the diverse makeup, that you're completely in tension with Bakke itself?
Well, absolutely. I think it could be, Your Honor. It's one data point to look at. And I think one thing we know from the holistic plan versus the percentage plan is the percentage plan is looking at one criterion, class rank. That's it. Holistic plan is looking all across the board at the characteristics that the students bring. Not only do the minority students coming through that plan have higher SAT scores, but they bring the diversity of different perspectives, and they perform very well. In fact, they have performed better than percentage students in several years. And the University of Texas thinks the world of all its students. But
if you're going to maintain academic integrity, why is it essential to bring those students in with the higher scores to balance off the lower scores that are there?
We think it is, Your Honor. Now, the interest that we're talking about here is the diversity interest, and clearly the holistic students bring all the diversity that the Supreme Court has recognized as constitutionally achievable. Now the percentage plan, as Your Honor has pointed out in your prior decision, in many ways is at war with the diversity objective recognized by the Supreme Court and reaffirmed in this case. The percentage plan looking at that only one criterion. And I think the University of Texas concluded, looking at the system after 7 years and all the different race-neutral means that it tried, that it was not achieving its educational objectives and that additional measures were warranted.
Yeah, but what I'm suggesting is that those deficits in the 10% plan are there and have even been acknowledged by the Supreme Court itself. And why isn't the Texas entitled to try to solve those deficits itself, respond to those deficits by the plans that it adopted?
Oh, we think it is, Your Honor, and I think it's the mere presence of the percentage plan, if anything, makes it more critical to have this holistic counterpart, which complements the percentage plan and offsets its systematic drawbacks.
One of the concerns I have, that if we accept the plaintiff's argument here, the signal that goes out, I understand the signal he wants, you can't use race at all, but the signal that goes out is to the universities is that is quite the opposite, is you don't go to the 10% plan, which where 80% of the student body here is admitted without regard to race. Instead, what you do is you use race across the board.
I think that that's absolutely right.
And that's exactly what the message goes out there. And that seems to me to turn the whole thing upside down.
I think that that's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think that where you have the record here is the university trying all the different measures that have been pointed out, recruiting and outreach, holistic review with socioeconomic factors in place of race and the percentage plan, and yet they clearly were not advancing the ball. They were losing water, in the case of African Americans, significantly. And it's only at that point that they determined that the very limited consideration of race, which would be constitutional on its own and the framework set forth in Grutter, was necessary. And look at the results that they've achieved. Now, part of the argument is that these results are too minimal. We disagree with that. First of all, that argument takes out of the equation all of the diversity that the holistic students are bringing, including diversity within different racial groups. Second of all, if you do want to look at percentages, and the Supreme Court says that's not the right framework here, but if you do, then look at the increases that have been made. Now, there had been some focus in comparing the 2004 year, which is the last year that you had holistic review without race, to 2008. Now, there's a big problem with that. 2008 was an unusual year in that the percentage admits ballooned to over 80% of the class. So that comparison isn't a fair comparison. But look at 2006 and 2007. And this is on page 156A and 157A of the Supplemental Joint Appendix. If you do that comparison, just between the holistic classes, what you find is that in 2004, there were 15.2% minority admits, African Americans and Hispanics, which was about 328 Texas admits. If you go to 2007, the 15.2% ballooned to 23.6%, and you had 481 minority admits. That was 173 additional African American and Hispanic students with the addition of race in the holistic review. If you go back to 2006, and by the way, that's a 55% increase. If you go back to 2006, you take the, compare 2004, 15.2%, it goes up to 21.6%, 126 additional minority students. Clearly this plan was making an impact, and that's why our opponents conceded at the outset of this case that the consideration of race is meaningful and has helped increase minority admissions. This plan is helping. It's helping not only increasing the numbers, it's helping in the diversity on campus, it's helping to create a visibly open pathway to leadership. University of Texas takes very seriously its obligation as the flagship institution of higher learning for the state of Texas.
Let me take you to another subject. You have sort of danced with the jurisdictional problems, but not completely. I'm a little unclear exactly where we are on that. But for the fact that the Supreme Court has decided this case and remanded it, in part, it's taken the case and remanded it back to this court, which contains some sort of an implicit exercise of jurisdiction, a little more than a drive-by ruling. I'm not sure how you maintain that it's open. I also suggest to you that the submissions now before us have no causation at all, that there may be a very powerful argument as an original proposition that's true. But where are we in your view? How do you make that argument given the Supreme Court's ruling?
So I think that the most important point I would make is that Texas versus LeSage, I think, very much can be viewed as a liability and not a jurisdictional ruling. If you view it as a liability ruling, then there's no reason why the Supreme Court would have felt compelled to address that issue, because it would have been outside the question presented. And there's every reason for this court to address that issue.
Well, I understand the LeSage argument, but Supreme, that's the Supreme Court's case, and they're the ones who took this case, and the question on the cert battle was largely over this issue, and they took it anyway, and not surprisingly.
The standing issue, Your Honor, was not within the question presented. The question presented was much different. So the Supreme Court may well have.
Well, I understand that wasn't in the question presented, but it was very much part of the effort to responses are, I thought.
Well, I think from the Supreme Court's perspective, it's very important, as Your Honor no doubt appreciates, what's in the question presented.
But it was the duty of the Supreme Court to raise it, as all courts, if the jurisdiction is absent, and they were silent about it, and I noticed any inability on the part of the court when they choose to do so to find those things.
But and I take that, Your Honor, if it's a jurisdictional rule, but if Texas versus LeSage is a liability rule, and that's what it speaks in terms of. It does cite standing cases. But it speaks in terms of liability.
Mr. Garth, you know, that was an individual case. They said that was individual discrimination, not departmental discrimination. This is a university-wide discrimination. They mentioned the Adirondack case, and they distinguished that case, that wasn't before them. It's a different case. And had they thought that this was a LeSage case, it would seem to me that would have been brought up by the Supreme Court.
Your Honor, the difference is that in the other cases, including that my friend focuses on, there were class claims. Here there's no class. There's an individual.
But it's across-the-board discrimination, where in LeSage it was individual discrimination.
Your Honor, having not made a class claim, she cannot complain on behalf of other students across the board.
Nobody's saying that. I'm just saying that the distinction between this case and that case is a different sort of allegation as to the basis of the discrimination.
Well, Your Honor, the claim in LeSage was that the students had been denied equal protection. Because
not the students, a student, a PhD candidate.
And that's the claim here, Your Honor. Ms. Fisher?
No, the claim here is that across the board there is discrimination, and therefore the effect is on her. Not that there was individual discrimination by the individuals of that department.
Your Honor, I would take a different view of the case, but our submission on standing, just to be unclear on that, is that she hasn't shown any redressable injury because she can't show that she was injured in any way by the university's consideration of race with respect to her, or frankly, with respect to anyone. And the reason why that's so is because the summary judgment record is unrebutted that nobody was admitted to the classes that Ms. Fisher applied to for the fall of 2008 with her academic achievements index score of 3.1.
Different question. Assume for the moment that the mandate of the Supreme Court did not take away the customary discretion we have to remand this to the district court. What is your view with regard to remand? If it's remand, what is going to be accomplished there?
Well, Your Honors, if there's any aspect of this case where you don't feel that the record does meet the university's burden, then certainly we would ask the court to remand so that we can put in additional evidence into the record. But our view is that the record is sufficient. Now, we take, as the Supreme Court said, and as Judge Garza mentioned earlier, that we have a burden to meet here and that this court has to look at the record with a searching inquiry. But we think that the record does satisfy that inquiry, and that's in large part because the material facts are not disputed here. Most of their objections go to legal arguments about what should be considered, what is relevant. When it gets down to the impact of the plan at issue here, the facts, I think, are largely undisputed on that, and we think that clearly there was a significant impact. When it comes down to the interplay between the percentage plan and the holistic plan, the record is irrefutable in terms of the race-neutral alternatives that Texas tried for 7 years before it adopted the plan at issue.
Can I ask a question when you finish? What's the university's position about the position that the United States takes in its amicus brief? Do you think that, do you agree that we need to go down the path that the United States is suggesting?
Well, Your Honor, we certainly agree with the United States' ultimate conclusion that the record is sufficient here. Now, we've approached it in a slightly different way. The one area where I think there is a small disagreement is we think that the critical mass issue is part of the compelling interest determination. That's the way the district court treated it. That's the way I think this court understood it. And that's the way Ms. Fisher herself briefed it in the prior appeal. So that's the one area where I think we disagree. I think the United States, although it may have approached the deference issue slightly differently, I think the most important part of its brief is all of the indicia from the record that it points to as to why the record is sufficient here. Now, the university, as any university would, has an important burden to meet here. but we think that the record before this court meets that burden. We think that they've questioned none of the factual premises or really record premises for this court's prior ruling. So we would ask this court, give this record the search and inquiry the Supreme Court called for and affirm the judgment for the University of Texas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Sivan.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the Black Student Alliance and the Black Ex-Students of Texas. I wanted to start with the question of remand that Judge Higginbotham asked towards the end. While we agree with the university entirely that the record is sufficient here, we think that a remand might be helpful just that in the similar way that the Supreme Court remanded out of fairness to the courts that heard the case, that a remand here to the district court may be helpful in the first instance to dispel any doubts and clarify some of the questions. We agree with the importance and of a race-conscious, holistic review as supplementing in a meaningful way a top 10% plan like the university used here and a PAI plan that has individualized review without race. But some of the additional issues about clustering and about reinforcing stereotypes, we think that there's plenty of evidence that could corroborate the important conclusions that UT found here. And I think that those issues and the indicia, I wanted to address Judge Garza's point about what are the indicia of critical mass. And I think that as the Supreme Court set forth in Grutter and stressed in Fisher, while a target is not, a numerical target is not the way to go, although numbers, some attention to numbers is important, the factors that this court stressed, whether they were increased perspectives, professionalism, civic engagement, diversity within diversity, I think are all susceptible to looking at record evidence and seeing, for instance, whether the university and the experience of the university was helpful in breaking down stereotypes in producing that broad diversity in those classroom experiences that have been stressed as so meaningful to the court. And I think that when looking at the record and making sure that that evidence to corroborate what has already been put into the record, whether it's in the plentiful amicus briefs that were put in the Supreme Court or here on review, for instance, in addition to the issues about reinforcing or breaking down stereotypes that Judge Higginbotham was stressing, the Coalition for Black Male Achievement put in a brief that talked about diversity if you disaggregate by gender and the importance of black males on campus, and that 35% on average of African American males were coming in through the individualized review. Diversity among gender within African Americans, within a minority group, are critical to fully gaining the benefits of diversity that this court has stressed.
Wouldn't that be considered under the PAI, the Personal Achievement Index?
As a
factor.
Yes, of course. But I think that the key addition here is to make sure, and I think the record showed that the PII without consideration of race was, in terms of minorities and in terms of African American males, for instance, wasn't achieving diversity in the same way that a use of race as a modest factor in addition was making sure that the PII students were diverse among and within themselves.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think we want to return to ask the questions the Supreme Court told you to answer. Was it necessary to use race? That had to be based on the record the university made. You can make up all kinds of other evidence that they might have used, but they never looked at it. Why did they employ race? Because, one, they thought the numbers demographically were not good, and two, they were concerned about the classroom, which, as Judge Higginbotham pointed out, Judge Garza's pointed out, they come from a different source. So what did the injection of race really mean? Here they've labeled every applicant by race. They're all now going to be PAI'd, taking into consideration race one way or the other. So they've got a pervasive use of race. But what does it accomplish? And what we've shown in the brief, and Judge Garza, you pointed out this last time, it's a minimal impact. Now they say, well, you know, the bigger the percentage of the class that comes under the PAI system, the bigger the impact, the number. But the percentage, if you look at those percentages, are always the same. It's 2%.
Is it because it's not producing enough, or is it because they're producing too much?
Well, it is because the Supreme Court has said if you have only a minimal impact, then alternate means might be just as efficient. You've got to look very hard as to whether it's necessary. Necessary is the word the Supreme Court said. You have to verify that necessity.
But that was as to a freestanding single operation. It was not as a supplement to a 10% plan or to a plan where they've already taken
8%. They said it in this case, and there was a 10% plan in this case. They say you must verify necessity, and that means you take into account what is this really doing, and is there an alternative means that would do it about as well? And what we have pointed out is if you really looked at what the 1998 to 2004 system was doing, it was constantly increasing minority admits. It was increasing them because 15%, a little more, of the PAI admits without race were minority admits. And you added those to the top 10 admits and you had numbers. They were looking at numbers. Look at the record. They're making all this up now. You know, diversity within diversity. There's no study of that. There's no record to support it. They did it for two reasons. One, they said the numbers are no good. And two, they said we've looked at the classrooms. Now, Judge Garcia, you pointed out they haven't done a darn thing about the classrooms. Nothing they've done touches the classroom. They have no study as the impact of the additional admissions on the classrooms. They don't even know what it contributes to enrollment. So there's no. So when you talk about the record, there is no record. You can't go down and supplement it by making the reasons up now. The question is, what justified the necessity at the time they made it?
Well, let me see, what is the unfairness of letting the university go forward under the standard? But we obviously, the district court and this court were seriously mistaken in not following the dissent in Grutter. But they have not having anticipated that that would become going forward, in fairness, perhaps they ought to be allowed to meet the standard. Now, one can say, well, that's always the standard. Well, of course, strict scrutiny was always the standard. But it was strict scrutiny in the case by Justice O'Connor applied,
well,
and
this
to
case,
which Justice Kennedy dissented.
This case was argued.
And the data he brought back.
If I could get a minute. This case was argued on strict scrutiny. That's the position we took from the beginning. So they're fully aware of the issue. They haven't told you what evidence they're going to bring in. Mr. Sibin wants to bring in all ex post evidence to say, well, it's a good idea. That's not permissible. The record is clear. We know why they did it. We know why they say they did it. We know what its effect was. Its minimal effect. You can look, 2% above the PAI. The PAI was an effective tool in addition to the top 10. The election was to use the top 10. If they'd used the PAI across the board, they would have still had about 15% or more minority admissions. They could weight the PAI differently. They could reduce the essay component, which is academic, and take more account of the personal achievement component. That would raise the numbers. There are many, many things they could readily do. They could move to a Grutter system. They could say, you know what, we're going to fill up 90% of the college in the individual classes with the way we do it, you know, by numbers, but we're going to take the close candidates and look at them individually, holistically, one-on-one, the way the Harvard plan works. They could do that. They haven't looked at that. They haven't looked at a darn thing. What they did was they looked at Grutter and said, the green light is on. Now, what is their view of narrow tailoring? It is, we've avoided the traps, there is no quota as such, and we don't use a determinative fixed number of points. We're okay, and we have a lot of factors. Now, that's not enough. You have to show the fit, because their view of tailoring is I walk into the tailor shop and I say, well, make a suit, and I really want it to have a nice close fit for my friend. And the tailor says, what do you want? Well, I want it to have pleats, and I want this, and I want that, and deliver it. And the tailor says, what's the size of your friend? You say, I'll know it when I see it. I'll know it when I see it. That's what they're telling you. They have no metric for what the tailoring is supposed to accomplish. What is the goal? They have no critical mass. The critical mass is when we feel like it, we will tell you. And how can you review it? You've got to do the job the Supreme Court gave to this court. You've got to verify necessity. And I see my time is up here. I won't tax your patience.
The court will be in recess under the usual order.